Okay, so I was asked by Ralph to give an introduction, well, in fact, it was by a group of the participants to sort of give an introduction to heterotic compactifications, smooth heterotic compactifications. And the phrase that one of the guys used to me was, you can't make it basic enough. And I'm going to take this to heart. So I can see some people in the room who are probably not going to learn anything here, so feel free to bail. On the other hand, I've got a sort of rough plan. But if people want to take this in a different way, or there's different things they want to learn about, just shout out and stop, and we'll just go in a different direction. This shouldn't be in any way any formal thing. People should just do whatever they want. But I've got a sort of basic plan I thought I'd try, which was essentially, first of all, to discuss backgrounds from the point of view of the 10D action of the heterotic string. And the reason for doing that is there's two types of heterotic theories that are used. There's the old weakly coupled string, which is a 10D theory. And then there's this 11D theory called heterotic M theory. But by the time you've compactified the 11D one down to 10D, it's the same action, right? So if you just start in 10D, you can do both at once, and so you save yourself some hassle. So I was going to talk about the 10D theory and show you the sort of usual ansatz that people would make for getting a supersymmetric compactification of that to give an N equals 1 4D theory, and what metric you need and what gauge fields you need. So for some people this is very basic stuff, but if you've not seen it, then obviously it's not. But what I wanted to concentrate on after that was, how do you actually describe this metric, and how do you actually describe these gauge fields? And I think this is where the terminology and the notation starts to look a bit funny, because you can't write down what the metric actually is. And the equation for the gauge field depends on the metric, so you can't even write down the equation for the gauge field, let alone solve it. And so you use these methods of algebraic geometry, and I just wanted to give you examples and show you how you actually describe these things and how you can get anything useful out of one of these compactifications without actually knowing anything except topology of the compactification space. So once you understand this, once you understand these backgrounds, getting the 4D theory and understanding what people are doing there, which is basically what we've been hearing about for the first half of the week, is a lot easier. Once you understand and speak the language, very easy to see where some of these things come from. So I'll spend a lot of time on the backgrounds, and then I'll talk a bit about the dimension reduction. And the things I was going to try and do were where the matter comes from and why it's described by these cohomology groups that people have seen. And then talk a little bit about Yukawa couplings and why they're something you can actually compute in this setting. So as I say, that's a pretty basic thing, but this is, it can get complicated. I was going to try and fit something in about the gravitational sector as well, because there's, moduli stabilization is perhaps the biggest weakness of this type of compactification. But I figure I won't get time, but if we skip some stuff, then we can talk about it. So I'm hoping people are just going to shout out at me at random times. So I was just going to start. Yeah, no throwing stuff. That's the only rule. Right? I'm hoping that I'm not going to need body on. Anyway, so I'm going to start with the 10D action of either heterotic M theory or the heterotic string. You have some 10D Newton constant, so you don't actually need the action very much, but you probably ought to see what theory we're talking about. Root G. And then you just have, obviously it's a string theory, so you have the Ricci tensor. You have a field called the dilaton, which in the weakly coupled language is the string coupling, more or less. Then you have the Nebeschwartz B field, which has, which I'm doing in some horrible note. So this is just the usual three-form field strength of a two-form potential. So this is just a standard Nebeschwartz sector. And then the thing that you have in heterotic is, even without brains, obviously, you have some gauge fields. And then you've got plus fermions. So the only really important features of these action is, so I'll be taking the case where these gauge fields lie in an E8 times E8 gauge group. The other option basically is SO32. One of the few important things really to note about this action is the sort of suppression of the gauge fields, kinetic terms, relative to, for example, gravity. So there's an extra factor of kappa 10 squared, which basically goes like alpha prime here, the string length. So the gauge fields are coming in, even to the action, at a higher order than gravity in heterotic. And that turns out to be important for the consistency of virtually everything that was said earlier this week. So that's the action, and the thing you really need to understand what's been going on this week is not really the action, but the supersymmetry variations. Obviously, there's all the fermion terms as well, which no one ever writes out. So to talk about supersymmetric vacua, you need to know about the fermion variations, and you've got the gravitinos, you've got the dilatino, and the gaugino, so the partners of this thing, and this thing. And you can just write out, or copy from Green, Schwartz, and Witten, what their variations are. So you have a covariant derivative acting on the super parameter, so this is the Suzy parameter. And then you have a bunch of flux terms, which is perhaps, so this is the variation of the gravitino, which is perhaps not too important to say what the flux terms are, other than to say there's a factor of this 10-dimensional kappa, Newton constant or inverse, and then some term depending on the flux, which is this H field. So that's the gravitino variation. The dilaton variation is, well, that's what I'm saying. A gamma matrix contracted with the derivative of the dilaton acting on the Suzy parameter. And then again, another flux term, which is suppressed again by a factor of kappa 10. And finally, you have the Suzy partners to the gauge fields. And they have a variation, and that looks like that. And with one exception, which I'll mention later on, that's pretty much it. So everything that we've seen in some of these more complicated talks earlier in the week is basically solutions to this system. It's just that the solutions look a lot more complicated than the system does itself. Okay, so the simple, we can look at a simple solution to this, which is basically, I mean, you'll see how special this solution is. And this is basically everything that's been done in model building heterotics since the 80s is based on this one special case. And the problem with this one special case is it doesn't seem to be any good for moduli stabilization. But who knows? So the way you solve this is you take this system. You take d phi equals 0 and h equals 0. And that implies, for example, that the variation of the dilatino is going to vanish. So supersymmetry won't be broken by this variation, just because that's 0 and flux is gone as well. To get this one to vanish, if the flux vanishes, you just need a covariantly constant spinner. So if a given Suzy parameter is going to be preserved by the background, is going to be satisfied by our dimensional reduction, preserved by our dimensional reduction, then it needs to be covariantly constant. And this is the thing that leads to the Calabi-Yau condition, so let's just have a look at how that goes. So we're going to want to do a compactification, so we're going to take space-time, which is our 10-dimensional manifold, to be a product of, in fact, four-dimensional Minkowski space and a six-dimensional space. Now, if you take SO19, the thing we start with, the Hohmann group, if you like, we start with, this spinner is a 16 representation of that. And we're going to break that up into a subgroup, which is SO1,3 times SO6. And under that splitting, this spinner breaks up into a 2, the conjugate 2, if you like, and some 4 representations of SO6. Now, the spinner of SO6 is isomorphic to SU4. And so the spinner of SO6 is actually just the fundamental of SU4.
for.
So this is the structure, and we want to ask for the right number of covariantly constant spinners to preserve n equals 1. So how are we going to do that? Well, if I look here, if I had 1, 2, and it's conjugate 2 prime in some sense, that would be one supersymmetry in 4D, four supercharges. So of this 4, I only want 1 to be covariantly constant. So I want 1 of these 4 spinners, if you like, to satisfy an equation like this. So the way you do that is you look at the holonomy group, and you want the holonomy group to act trivially on one spinner. That would mean it's covariantly constant. So in general, the holonomy of a six-dimensional manifold lies in SO6, which is SU4. So I've got some 4x4 matrix acting on the spinners. But if I take the holonomy to be special, so if I take the holonomy to lie in a subgroup of SU4, which is just SU3, then a spinner, so in general you have a spinner that's got 4 entries. But if I take the spinner to be of the form 0, 0, 0, something, then this holonomy group will leave this spinner alone. Right? So if I act with the holonomy group on this spinner, then nothing happens. And that means that for a manifold that has SU3 holonomy, this equation is satisfied by precisely one of the 4 spinners here. So that's the basic idea. So everybody's very silent, and I know that there's at least half the audience that knows it very well, and I don't know if the other half knows it very well as well, or what. But anyway. So to get an n equals 1 compactification of this sort, with this type of ansatz, the condition is you want a manifold with SU3 holonomy. And that's what a Calabi-Yau is. So you can define a Calabi-Yau, if you like, as the thing that you compactify heterotic on to get n equals 1 supersymmetry. Another definition of a Calabi-Yau, which is equivalent, is that it's a a compact, Kähler, complex manifold with vanishing first Chern class. But essentially, that's all you're doing. So we solve this equation by setting the phi to the dilaton to a constant and flux to 0. We solve the Gravitino equation by choosing a Calabi-Yau manifold, and then we've solved the equation for one set of spinners that would correspond to one set of 4D supersymmetry. And that just leaves us with this equation to solve. And you may say, well, that one's easy because I just put F equals 0. But F equals 0 is not allowed, and this is where the pain starts. So the trouble is that the Bianchi identity for this field strength is not trivial. So normally, if you have a field strength, you would write something like that. You know, H is dB, so d of H is 0. But in heterotic, this thing is actually... I always get the sign wrong. It doesn't matter. So in other words, both the gauge field strength and the curvature of the manifold acts as a bulk charge, or acts as a charge for this Never-Schwarz form. Now the trouble is that we're on a compact manifold, so the sum of the charges have to add up to 0, because there's nowhere for field lines to go, basically. And for a Calabi-Yau manifold, which we've had to choose to satisfy this relation, these positive charges, if you like, are non-zero, so we need some negative charges to cancel them. So the way you see that mathematically is you've got your compact six-dimensional manifold. This is a 4 form on both sides, so you just integrate it over any 4 cycle in the manifold. So let's take a basis of 4 cycles in our manifold CI. If I integrate the left-hand side, it's a total derivative, so I get 0. So 0 is the integral over CI of trace F wedge F plus the integral over CI trace R wedge R. And if you like, this is just the integrability condition for this equation. And these numbers, which are basically second churn characters, these are up to factors of 2 pi that I'll never get right in a million years. They're integers. And these integers are non-zero for the club EL. So you have to turn on an F. You've not got a choice. If you don't turn on an F, you just simply won't be able to solve the equation. This is a royal pain in the neck.
Isn't it good? Because otherwise you'd have the A cross the engaged symmetry in that one.
Sure, yeah. Okay, it depends what you like. If you're really theoretical and you just want an easy time solving the equation, this is a pain. But yeah, it would be kind of disappointing if you... Yeah. I mean, this is a good point that Shamet raises. So what we're going to see later on is that you want to use these gauge fields in the internal dimensions to break some of the E8 symmetry down to something lower. And if this term wasn't there, this wouldn't be possible. Because I wouldn't be able to turn on gauge fields that were topologically non-trivial to break the symmetry if there was no charge to cancel them. So in some sense, you need it.
Just a remedial question that I'm getting, but is there some form of this where you would write H minus the turn sinus forms on E squared?
Yeah, this is a good... I mean, the reason I'm not doing that is you can really only do that locally, but yeah. From here, what you were saying is if I write... sort of on a local patch or something, the solution to this, it's H equals dB minus omega 3 Yang Mills plus omega 3 Lorentz. And this omega 3 is a 3 form, and it, essentially its definition is D of omega 3 equals F wedge F. Right? So if you take DH, you get 0 and then F wedge F and then R wedge R. So locally, this is what you've got. And this leads to all sorts of fun and games. So this omega 3 is a function of the gauge fields, and it's not actually gauge invariant. You want the field strength to be gauge invariant, and that means in heterotic, the B field transforms under gauge symmetries. So
in other words, that H includes all of this.
That's right. So in here, if you were doing a dimensional reduction of this and wanted to see where the gauge fields went, you would have to include this squared, for example, in the dimensional reduction, and if you don't, you don't get an n equals 1 theory. Yeah. Good. Okay, so we need some gauge field to cancel this charge problem. What do you choose? Well, it has to satisfy this equation. So things are getting quite nasty, right? So I have to have a gauge field which satisfies this condition and this equation. And you know, so you're on a club, yeah. We know that from this equation. We've chosen one spinner to be the spinner that's, one set of spinners to be the spinners that are preserved by the geometry reduction. And so the gauge fields have to preserve the same spinners. This equation has to be solved for the same spinner that was solved by the Gravitino variation equation. And you know what the structure of that is. What you essentially do is these gamma matrices, if you write it in terms of complex coordinates on the car BL, can be written in terms of a bunch of raising and lowering operators. And then when you do that, you can interpret the spinner that's preserved by the geometry as the totally full state. And then you can do your usual sort of laddering up and down and comparing spinners thing to simplify this equation. You can see this in Green-Schwarz and Witten, for example. And when you do that, you find that this equation is equivalent to FAB equals 0, to these three equations. In fact, it's just equivalent, I think, to that one and that one, but the gauge field is real. So A and B here are complex indices on the club EL. They run from 1 to 3. These are the conjugate indices. The metric is automatically of this form, and these are the equations you get from this. So these are a specialization of what the mathematicians would call the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. They're the specialization to something called zero slope, and we'll see what's meant by that in a minute. That actually causes a lot of confusion sometimes in the literature, so be careful. It's not the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, it's a specialization.
Yeah.
In fact, this is important because sometimes, I mean, it's that gives you the D term sometimes. You have to be a bit... So what we need to solve our supersymmetry equations is a solution to this and a solution to this, right, for the given Calabi-Yau we come up with. So you plug in the Calabi-Yau metric here and here, and you have to you have to just dream up a gauge field configuration with exactly this second Chern character which obeys these equations. And this is where things start to get difficult. And there's essentially two types of solution to this. One type which was used extensively in the 80s, and one type which is what we've heard about for the entirety of this week. So the first type of solution is...
You might look for something, I mean, you mentioned the term. Mm-hmm. You might look, start from this, not look for a supersymmetric decision, but look for something which has a supersymmetric effective theory.
Yes.
Which somewhere in the space of these fields reduces to some kind of a Raftery model. Which
and then try and find the vacuum.
Is that something that's possible or that's ruled out? Or
That's a very good question. I mean, if you don't solve these equations, and then you compactify using the usual expansions, you won't get a supersymmetric theory. But if you, there probably is some modification where you keep some extra stuff and you will, and then
you... You mean you won't even get a supersymmetric effective theory at all?
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense generally.
Yeah. But I mean, if you changed your expansion, I mean, what's happening there, right, is you're just throwing away some of the stuff that would have made it. So if you can think of another way of doing it. So a good example of something like that that happens is... This is jumping the gun, but in heterotic M theory, you've got to compactify 11 dimensions and then on the Calabi-Yau. But you don't have to do that. If you compactify on the Calabi-Yau, you don't have to find the full 11D solution. If you compactify on the Calabi-Yau alone, you get a supersymmetric theory, just like you're saying. And then you can find the solution by solving that 5D theory, which is simpler than solving that. Yeah. Okay, so... All we have to do, all we've got left to do is solve these equations subject to this constraint. This constraint can be loosened, but we'll worry about that later. And there's two types of solution.
You will try to cancel also locally,
right? That's a very good question, and I'm just about to get to it. So the first solution is going to cancel it locally, and the second one isn't, and this is a cause of much discussion. That shouldn't be. So the first type of solution is called the standard embedding. So there's a whole bunch of people that did model building using this embedding, and I'm not going to mention anyone because I will almost certainly forget someone else. But people got quite close to the standard model with this kind of thing. And what you do is you're going to choose some background gauge field. And because I'm going to have perturbations in the gauge field as well, I'm going to choose the background solution, the actual solution to these equations. I'm going to call the gauge field that goes with it ABG for A background. And it has some index on it. And one solution, which I think was probably suggested by Witten, was just that you can take it to be equal to the spin connection of the Calabi-Yau. So the Calabi-Yau is a manifold with SU3 holonomy. Okay, so the spin connection lies in SU3. And so you can get an SU3 gauge field VEV here just by setting the spin connection equal to the gauge field. That's just a solution. The nice thing about this is if you choose these two things to same, you're just saying that F wedge F is equal to R wedge R, which is a really nice way of solving this equation, especially seeing as we had H equals 0. So what you do is you take F wedge F equal to R wedge R, and then DH equals 0. And it turns out that in such a case, you're guaranteed to solve these equations. And it's probably easier to say what that is once we've introduced a bit more machinery. So this is called the standard embedding, and people did a lot of this. The trouble with it is it's pretty specific. You'll see, that, especially when we go to heterotic M theory, you'll see that there's nothing particularly special about this. And the other problem is that we had a manifold of SU3 holonomy. So your gauge field here lies in SU3 inside E8. So you have this E8 gauge group, but the gauge field VEVs only lie in SU3, which means that the only thing you're ever going to get like this, it turns out, and again we'll discuss this more later, is an E6 gut theory in four dimensions, basically because E6 is the part of E8 that commutes with the VEVs that you've just given. So that's one solution called the standard embedding, and there's another solution called the non-standard embedding, which is essentially anything else. So in the non-standard embedding, you can just define it literally by not equal to M-gray. Advantage of this is that you're not restricted to SU3 anymore, right? You can do what you like. And there's a whole bunch of solutions that are not related to the gravitational solution that you can write down. So this is a much bigger set.
But you're going to keep H topologically trivial when you say non-standard thing.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a very good point. So the way I always think about it, which is probably a bit dodgy, but I find it useful. So the problem here is you have to find a solution here so that F wedge F is equal to R wedge R. If you don't, there is no solution to this equation. However, now F wedge F is not going to be equal to R wedge R. So these two integrals will be the same, but the actual forms point by point on the compactification space will not be the same, which means that dH is not equal to 0. Okay? And in the start of all my compactification, I said H equals 0, off I go. Right? So this looks completely inconsistent. And the reason it's not is essentially precisely this suppression. Well, one way of seeing why it's not is precisely this suppression in front of the gauge field terms. Imagine doing this order by order, if you like, in kappa 10 or alpha prime or whatever you want to call it. At zeroth order, the gauge fields wouldn't even be there. So then I get a Calabi-Yau.
If I wrote this
in a different convention, you would see alpha primes out the front here, and dH would be zero, and everything would be fine. And then you go to next order in alpha prime, the gauge fields appear, I have to solve for them. I find that that's giving a non-trivial H, but it's at the next order in alpha prime. So at zeroth order in alpha prime, I have a Ricci flat Calabi-Yau. At next order in alpha prime, there's some extra source that's causing some extra curvature on the manifold. But that doesn't change the topology of the manifold. So when you just have the geometry at the start before you put on the gauge fields, the manifold will have a vanishing Ricci tensor, the Ricci flat metric on the Calabi-Yau. We'll talk about this in a minute. When you add the gauge fields, it will no longer be Ricci flat. It will start to get some extra curvature, but its topology is not changing. Or we hope. I think. Pretty good. So there's a paper by Witten and Witten that actually goes through this in some detail. And the reason why this is important is because virtually everything we'll be able to say about the compactification is based on the topology of the space and not the actual geometry. So I don't care that this happens, as long as I can solve this equation, and as long as the back reaction from this extra piece of H is somehow small.
What they proved is you can actually solve it to all orders, just to first order.
I think they argue to all orders, but they, yeah. Yeah.
No, if you do consider a topologically non-trivial H flux, mm-hmm. or a large radius,
yeah.
This would be an example of what I was asking about before, I think, where you still have a low energy effect in theory.
Yeah.
Because
I think that
the H gives masses that are sub-kk.
Yep.
And maybe you want something like that, because at the end of the day, you want a spontaneously broken.
I completely agree with what you said. So I'm sure there's lots of papers on this, but one of the papers I know is a paper by Dan Waldron that discusses some of this. The trouble is, right, even though if you turn on a topologically non-trivial H here and it back reacts on the geometry, even though locally, if you take the volume large, it's only back reacting in a small way, it does change the topology.
So you lose control of your...
So I wouldn't be able to use the same topological techniques.
Didn't Strominger prove that if you turn on H and try to satisfy those equations there, mm-hmm. satisfy them, they go to quantize? Volume gets fixed, right?
Right. So
you're not going to be a large volume if you satisfy the spinner conditions.
But
you're not satisfying.
Yeah, no, but this is exactly.
It would allow you the supersymmetric solution where you had.
Yeah, but this is exactly the point.
That exists, right?
Well, I guess we know that the Fu-Yau solution, there's special cases we know exist. But yeah, we are getting ahead, but just say two things because we probably won't get there anyway. So this is the simplest thing that everybody does because the model building works. The trouble is that when you try and stabilize the moduli, everything goes to hell in a handbasket. Right? You've got not enough potential contributions here because the manifold is Ricci flat. If you dimensionally reduce the Ricci scalar, it doesn't give you any potential terms, and that's a problem. So people try and look at more general solutions to this system to try and stabilize the moduli. The trouble is they all change the topology, and then the model building I'm going to show you doesn't work. One thing I just wanted to say is people always talk about the Strominger system, and rightly so, which is a solution to these equations perturbatively. It's in fact the general way you solve these. But that may not be the thing we want to do, because we also want to add in non-perturbative effects, and it may be you don't want to solve the system perturbatively. And one thing you can do is you can compactify, instead of on a manifold of SU3 holonomy, you can compactify on a manifold of general SU3 structure, then you won't have a Minkowski ground space to the theory. The 4D solution is generally some kind of domain wall, but you can then try and fix that up with other effects. So there's a whole range of things to do here, and I was just sticking to the...
Right, in other words, just one last thing.
Yeah.
It's not that you are a phenomenology require this exactly supersymmetric solution. Even if you want to use Suzy phenomenology, what you require is a spontaneously broken...
Precisely.
So these might not be the right equations to solve.
Absolutely, and even if you wanted a supersymmetric ground state, they still may not
they
be.
They still may not be,
yeah. Absolutely.
So, and the loopholes you were solving for Minkowski supersymmetry here, you could get ADS supersymmetry?
Or just that you were solving it perturbatively. And, you know, you're going to have to be lucky to play off a non-perturbative effect against a perturbative one. We know that, right? But still.
Just one comment on why we haven't gone to this more attractive route. Is that from an algebraic geometry perspective, once you lose the Kalman condition, you've done virtually nothing about building these apps.
So there's nothing like Gauss theorem and you just have to write down a metric?
No.
There are in special cases.
Well, okay, there are some special cases, but in general, for non-Taylor geometry, algebraic geometry falls apart. You just don't have an
entry. Okay.
So, mm-hmm. Is your Dilantino variation, is that a problem that now your dilaton is also running?
Same thing. Same thing. Same thing. So, the flux is now going to source a derivative to the thing, the dilaton, but again, it's suppressed by this kappa 10. So it's the same sort of thing. And you can see this in specific solutions. So basically, for example, you can take a Yang-Mills instanton and just sort of plonk it down on your manifold if you're doing some kind of orbifold construction. And you can see that you have basically a constant phi, and then you get this little perturbation to the dilaton on the space where it's back-reacted from the gauge field. Basically a modification of the solution by Schrödinger. So again, same thing, it will change. You have to worry about it, but it's a small perturbation. Okay, so let's bring it back to Calabi-Yau for a few minutes, if that's okay. The problem with all this, and the reason that the talks have looked completely alien this week, is that you cannot do anything I just said. Right? So you do not know what the metric on a Calabi-Yau manifold is, generally, and you cannot solve for it except numerically, even in special cases there. And if you don't know what the metric is, you don't even know what the equations for the gauge field are, let alone solving them. So it's not like you can just solve for the metric, solve for the gauge field, plug it into this action, integrate out six dimensions, get a 4D theory. It's not going to happen. So what do you do? Well, what you rely on, and Lara was just sort of referring to this, is you rely on the fact that you can prove the existence of solutions to these equations, even if you don't know what that solution is. And you know stuff about the topology of those equations. And much of the stuff that we want to know, spectrum, Yukawa couplings, is at least quasi-topological. So even though you don't know the solution, you can still work some stuff out. So I just wanted to say a few words about how you actually do that. And I was going to start with the metric and then do some gauge field stuff. So for the metric, you rely on Yau's proof of the Calabi conjecture. And there's a sort of general statement of this which we don't need. And basically, what it boils down to for us is that if you have one of these manifolds of SU3 holonomy, and you pick some moduli, for every choice of moduli, there is precisely one and only one. It's a unique Ricci-flat Kähler metric on that space. So any compact Kähler manifold with C1 equals 0 has a unique G metric with mu equals 0. So all you have to do is find a manifold that's compact, Kähler, check its C1 is equal to 0, and then you know you have a solution. So how do you do that? Well, let's take the example of a hypersurface in Pn. So what does this notation mean? What this means is I'm going to take n-dimensional projective space, usual thing with homogeneous coordinates and rescaling, and I'm going to take a homogeneous degree q polynomial in that projective space, and where that polynomial vanishes is a surface inside projective space, and I'm going to try and engineer that surface to be a Calabi-Yau. Okay. So So I have some polynomial, some projective space, I have the zero locus of a polynomial, and I'm going to try and engineer this zero locus to be a Calabi-Yau. So how do you do that? Well, projective space is compact and complex, and in fact, Kähler. And it's a fact that if you take, you can just pull back a Kähler form, basically, that any complex subspace like this of a compact Kähler manifold is also compact and Kähler. So we're pretty much there. The only thing I have to check here is that C1 equals zero. Now, the first Chern class of a manifold is a topological thing. I need a metric to work it out, but I can just use any old metric. It doesn't matter which one I use. I'll get the same answer. It's topological. And we know a nice metric on Pn. So on Pn, we have something called the Fibini study metric, which is basically the metric who, when you write it in terms of the homogeneous coordinates on projective space, is just log mod some of the mod squares of the coordinates. And you can work out this metric, and you can then, from the metric on the total space, you can work out the metric on the surface. Okay? And then you can calculate its Ricci form. So you calculate the Ricci form on, let's call this surface F, of the Fibini study metric pulled back to the locus of my degree Q polynomial vanishing, and you get this. This is the Fibini study metric pulled back to F, plus terms that look like total derivatives. So the point is, if I take my Ricci form and I integrate it over some two cycles, which basically gives me the Chern class, the total derivatives will get B0. So to get a manifold with zero Chern class, I just have to set this piece to zero. You can do this explicitly. This is just GR and restricting the metric. Okay, so what do I choose for Q and N to make this zero? Well, it's fairly obvious. I've got a hypersurface inside projective N space. I want a six manifold, so a three-dimensional complex manifold. So I want N to be four, so then I take away one for the locus, I get a three manifold. So if I choose N equals four, this vanishes and I get a vanishing first Chern class if Q equals five. And that's why this manifold, which is called the quintic, is a Calabi-Yau space. So the point is that if I choose such a manifold, Yau's theorem tells me that I don't need to solve for the metric because there is a Ricci flat metric on that manifold and it's unique for a choice of moduli. So there's other things you can do. There's a whole class that's just like the ones that I just showed you, and you do everything to prove their existence in exactly the same way. Another example of this class would be my favorite manifold, which is this one. So it's exactly the same thing. Instead of one projective space, I take a product of two, and then I have a polynomial that's degree three in the coordinates of one projective space and degree three in the coordinates of the other at the same time. And you can just classify all of the Calabi-Yau of this type. It turns out there's 7,890, which, believe it or not, is an absolutely tiny class of all the Calabi-Yaus we know. But this is, you know, a set you can start to play with.
That's including weighted projective spaces.
No, that was just pure in products. If you include weighted, then there's lots more. And if you include, obviously, the biggest data set is something called the toric, and then you go to billions of these guys. I don't know if Lara knows the exact number.
How many sets of odd numbers just a few hundred?
In the CCs, in these guys.
Well, or even the toric. I mean, it's not, they're billions, but there's just a few hundred odd numbers, right?
I think it's more than a few hundred. Yeah.
And it's about half a billion. This is just hypersurfaces of toric, right? There is something
that's. In fact, I mean, do they count when they do the torics? Do they count just different Hodge numbers? Or do they count? I don't know.
From all these, that's really your favorite.
It's what my standard model's on. That's lovely. Oh. Yeah, it's not really.
Is that the 7,000? Or are we sure that it's not double counting anything?
For this case, I think we are, yeah.
Sorry, no. The CCs, there is redundancy.
There is, okay.
It's not huge, and this is actually the answer. We looked at some of this. But
I should know that.
A lot of things that are strictly equivalent to FF, they might be equivalent to string theory just by class.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
It could be from string theory, there are very, very many less than a few billion.
Yeah, but I mean, even if they're related by a geometrical transition like that, you may still be interested in both.
Sure. Terms,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how you do the metric. So the only thing you're left to do is the gauge field. Okay. So the gauge field, you have just basically a similar kind of existence proof. And this one is due to Donaldson, Nuremberg, and Yao. So what they say, and this one looks unpleasant at first, but actually, well, actually it is unpleasant. This one, they say that on each polystable holomorphic vector bundle, V, there exists a solution to Hermitian-Yang-Mills. Now remember, the equations that we want to solve for the gauge field are a specialization of Hermitian-Yang-Mills. So as Shamet said earlier, the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations are an object called mu times the identity matrix and the gauge indices, and then FAB equals FA bar, E bar equals zero. So what we want to solve is these equations with that equals zero. This object's called the slope. So that's why I said the thing we're interested in is the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations with zero slope. So to explain what this is, I guess I better tell you what slope is and then what a polystable vector bundle is. So a holomorphic vector bundle is just one where the transition functions are holomorphic. There's other ways you can characterize it. But the stability thing is less obvious. So let's start by defining the slope. And Lara did this in her talk, but I'll just... So the slope of any vector bundle, or indeed more general objects called sheaves, is just a number. And it depends on the Kähler moduli. You get a different number for each Kähler moduli. And it's just defined to be 1 over the rank of your bundle or sheaf, and then an integral over the class Yau, which is the integral of the first Chern class wedged up with two Kähler forms. So the Kähler form is just a form which up to factors of I you may not quote me on, is given by the metric. So these Kähler forms depend on the Kähler moduli in the metric. This C1 is just some topological thing that's associated to the sheaf or bundle. And if you do this integral, you get a number associated to any sheaf. So basically, we're going to have some bundle that our gauge fields live on. And for it to be a solution to the equations we want, we're going to want that thing to have zero slope. Normally, that's not a problem because we normally have zero first Chern class. Okay. So that's slope. We need to know about stability. Let me just do it this way. So a bundle V is stable, this is the definition, if for all subsheaves F in V, so that's all sort of sub-objects, I'll describe a little bit more about what a sheaf is in a second, inside V, with rank greater than zero and less than that of V, the slope of the sub-object is less than the slope of V, which for us is going to equal zero. So what's a sheaf? You know, a bundle is like you have a vector space over each point on your manifold, and you sort of all of the vector spaces are the same, and you tie them together with some transition functions. One way of thinking about a sheaf is it's similar, but the vector spaces over each point don't have to be the same. So you could have, for example, one-dimensional vector space everywhere except at one point where it's two, just very roughly. So if we want to work out if a bundle is stable, we have to find every such sub-object. We have to work out its slope using such a formula. And once we've worked out its slope, we have to check that all the slopes of all sub-objects are negative. There's an infinite number of such sub-objects. You can imagine this is the hard part of creating a heterotic convective equation. One last piece of math is just that this is not stability that appears in our theorem. It's polystability. And V, a bundle, is polystable if it's equal to a sum of pieces where each piece is stable and all of the pieces have the same slope. This thing is just sort of an irritating technicality, basically. So basically what you want for physics is stable slope zero bundles, and then that gives you a solution to the Mishin-Yang-Mills equations, which came from this. It's just that this is a linear equation, so if I have two solutions that commute to this equation and I add them together, I get another solution, right? So in some sense, roughly speaking, that's what this sum is doing. I'm just adding together solutions.
Can you say just a little bit more about the intuition, the importance behind stability, and why stability is...
Yeah, I can. Yeah, okay. So at the level of finding a background, it's just what I've said. You want to solve the killing spinner equation. But what's actually happening here in physics is you're minimizing a D-term. So if I look at this term in the action, if I dimensionally reduce this, I get three types of term. I get FAB mod squared, dimensionally reducing. I get GAB bar, FAB bar squared. And then I get a term here, which is basically J wedge F wedge F. And this term is precisely cancelled by this term because of the Bianchi identity. So basically, when you dimensionally reduce this thing, you get two types of term, which don't depend on 4D derivatives and so are going to give you potentials in the 4D theory. When you work it out, this thing gives you dW mod squared. Right? You're going to get an N equals 1 4D theory. And this thing gives you a D term squared. So the reason stability is important is I want to solve the Donaldson and Beck, the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. These two parts of the equations just show that there is a holomorphic bundle, and this is the stability bit. So what you're doing by asking for a stable bundle is you're saying, can I solve this D term?
So this was covered in the Lawrence talk. Mm. The process of finding these sub objects with u less than zero, that just turned into charges.
I mean, that is, it's much, much harder. I mean, basically, in that stuff, we got the field theory because we knew how to do the algebraic geometry.
Right, I'm just asking.
How do you do this?
Again, is there some direct relation between this U less than U of B
yeah.
and the physics?
I mean, yeah. Say you have some part of the Kähler cone where mu of F is changing for some subsheaf F. And this is where it goes to zero, and this is where it goes positive. This mu of f, this particular subsheaf that's causing the instability, this mu of f is an fi term inside this d term. So there is a direct relation, yeah.
Is the u1
yeah.
Factor in?
Yeah, so this was Lara's talk. So what happened... okay, well, I'm happy to talk afterwards, but... Yeah, I mean, basically what happens is the gauge bundle splits into two on this line. You get an extra U1. There's a D term associated to that U1. And the FI term of that D term is this slope. But I wanted to show a few simpler examples, so maybe we could... Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, so all you need is a polystable holomorphic vector bundle. This really is the hard bit. If you're building a model, trying to prove something is stable is a nightmare.
Mm. So, I mean, the Alice theorem made this... the Claudial bit easy.
Mm-hmm.
Is it presumably stable bundles over PN have been studied extensively? Are there any theorems about restriction of stable bundles from PN to hypersurfaces that guarantee the stability remains absolute?
No, and this is a big part. Well, I mean, what we do on the semi-positive monads, for example, is some non-trivial calculations to still prove stability for it on a hypersurface, right?
I was just going to make one comment. So yeah. Yes, in general, but there isn't anything in general that but there are some.
Yeah.
One particular hypersurface.
Just a hypersurface. Oh, okay. A single hypersurface in a single PN.
As opposed to complete intersections.
Yeah.
Right. So it works with Quintic and nothing else, basically. And yeah. Otherwise, you have to work.
And sometimes. Sorry.
The calculation you have to do combinatorial if you know you have some mode out.
You have to work out cohomology, basically. And the reason you have, in general, you have to work out cohomology is you have to know, for example, if something is a subobject. So I need to work out HOM F. V to see if F maps into V, but that's the zero of cohomology of F star tensor V.
You have to do this for all sub. Okay, so it's actually just the sorry.
In some cases, it's simpler. So Lara mentioned one example. Another example would be Hopper's theorem, which says in certain cases, you can check stability just by calculating it through H zeros. But
is it expected there are more such theorems and just no one bothered working on it? It's not a really natural question for mathematicians to care about restrictions.
I've asked one of the world experts on stability of electric bubbles about this, and the problem is that this scales badly. The sort of the size of the Taylor problem and the size of the space from certain PN, you know, you've got one Taylor module.
I see.
And okay. When you get into big spaces, mathematicians don't really have a general.
I mean, these guys asked, this is before I joined the collaboration, these guys asked this mathematician a question, and at some stage he actually used the phrase, obviously obvious. And then couldn't compute it. But.
It is obviously obvious, it's not going to work.
And it did. Okay, so basic message is it's hard. But let's just do a few simple examples so you can see the type of things that people have been putting up on the board, if I've got a few minutes. So we had this manifold, the quintic P45. So let's look at the line bundle, the sum of line bundles. Let's take V to be O1 plus O minus 1. So I've got to tell you what this means. So what a notation like O of P means, which we've seen like a million times, is that a line bundle on a Clavier is defined by its first Chern class. If you specify the first Chern class, you specify the line bundle. And what this means is that it's the line bundle such that the first Chern class is just P times the Kähler form. That's the definition. And another example on the gorgeous 3-3 manifold, okay, it's not that gorgeous, would be you would define a line bundle OPQ, again by its first Chern class. This now has two. It has H11 equals 2. There's two Kähler moduli. And if I have a basis for the 1-1 forms of J1, J2, which are actually restrictions from the Kähler forms on each of these Ps, OPQ is just the line bundle such that this thing is PJ1 plus QJ2. So you just define it by the Chern class, and then a couple of integers define the line bundle for you. So if we choose this bundle on the quintic, is this polystable? Well, line bundles are stable automatically. You don't have to check anything. So one way of seeing it is that I have to have the rank of the destabilizing object being less than the 1, which is the line bundle, and greater than 0.
But skyscraper sheaves, you're taking all possible sub-sheaves into
account. Yeah, so this is an algorithm that we use quite often. If you have any destabilizing subsheaf of any rank here, you can turn it into a what's called a line bundle subsheaf. So it's a line bundle that injects the sheaf into the bundle.
Yeah.
Hence greater than 0.
A line bundle will have.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
If you start considering sheaves instead, which many people
then you
don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
But for the vector bundles we're considering, you know, for a line bundle.
Yeah.
So there's no U1. Is there a physics reason
for
there's no
D-term
you can have?
Well, I mean, there's no structure that can split up and give you an extra U1, right? If I had an SU3 bundle, it can split into two pieces,
yeah.
And then the commutant can have an extra U1.
Right? Here, what is it, a U1 bundle?
Yeah, exactly. So the
field.
And okay, let me put it this way. Let me have another example where you can't have one line bundle. If I just had O1 just sitting on its own in the that's the bundle. Mm-hmm. This has a non-vanishing first Chern class by definition. But any subgroup of E8 has to have a vanishing. I mean, anything that was going to have a structure group of, that lies inside E8 would have to have a vanishing first Chern class because the trace of the generators would be 0. So this is not an allowed bundle because the structure group won't lie inside E8.
Oh.
So,
so that's a different argument.
That is a different argument, yeah. There may be a better one than that. But
so you said that it does cancel because of the slope being 0, 0, 0, 1.
Okay, so let's do this example, not quite. So the point is that in this example, we can ask if this is polystable, but it's not, because one of the conditions for polystability was that the slope of all the pieces is the same. Right? Here, The slope, remember, is this thing. And we have opposite first churn classes for these two pieces. So the slope of the two pieces is equal and opposite. They're not the same. This is not polystable. Let me give you a more complicated example, and then it's easier to see how these things interplay, believe it or not. So if instead of this one, we just think of something slightly more complicated, and I had so just a sum of three line bundles, this time on the 3-3. How does this one play out?
Yeah, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Like, can you explain your notation O equal
to Q again? Yeah, sure. So this manifold has... So this manifold has H11 equals 2. So in particular, the Kähler form would look something like J1, T2, J2 in general, in terms of a basis of H11. And you just pick a basis of H11. I've picked a particular basis here. And when you work out the first churn class, you write it as P times one basis element, Q times the other. And then the P and the Q are the only thing you need to specify this churn class, and that specifies it. Okay, so if we write down this guy, and I'll stop soon, I promise. If we write down this guy, you can manipulate the slope and see what's happening in Kähler moduli space in a bit more detail. So the slope is this C1 wedge J thing. If I write J, as I said, as an expansion in terms of a basis, and I write C1 in the same way for each line bundle, and I define the wedge product of three of my basis forms to be D. These are called the intersection numbers. They're just a bunch of integers in this case, threes and noughts. And finally, if I define, and Lara did this, a dual variable, which is just two Kähler moduli contracted with these intersection forms, which is just a different basis for variables on Kähler moduli space. Then if I do all this and I plug these definitions in, you can see that the slope of an object is just its churn class, C1i, dotted in with these new variables. It's just the dot product. So then I can look at whether these things can have the same slope for some choice of Kähler moduli. And what's happening here is that if I draw a Kähler moduli space, which is 2D in terms of S2 and S1, there is a line along here. If we look at the first line bundle with slope 1, where this is my churn class, so mu of O 1 minus 1 is equal to S1 minus S2. So the slope of this guy vanishes precisely on this line. Same for this guy, because it's the same line bundle. This guy has got minus 2 S1 plus 2 S2. And that vanishes on the same line. It vanishes on the line of slope 1 as well. So here I have a sum of line bundles, which are automatically stable. And their slope is all equal if I lie on this line in Kähler moduli space. And that means this is a polystable bundle. And so there is a solution to Hermitian-Yang Mills with zero slope on that line. What happens if you go off the line? Then it's a D-term. And this is basically what everybody's, well, what some of the ways of building bundles in heterotic look like. You just keep, you know about line bundles on your space, and you just keep building up more and more complicated structures. This one's no good for doing phenomenology, basically because the gauge field BEVs that this would correspond to would lie in the group S of U1 times U1 times U1. And you want something a bit more complicated to break the group down further. But you still do that by building things out of line bundles, and given the time, maybe this is the last thing I'll show you. So just to show you one way in which you would build a more complicated bundle, you could build something called a monad, which there are various experts on in the audience. And I'm going to look at a special case of a monad. So you could build something like... let's do something on the quintic again. And you could build something like, and I'll explain what this means. Our bundle V, this is going to be the guy we're interested in. And we build it out of a sum of line bundles. One, two, three, four. Okay, so what does this mean? It's called a short exact sequence. So each of these objects is bundles. We've already defined what the line bundles are. It's basically U1 field strings. What this thing being short exact means is that each of these maps, which you can think of as maps on the fibers of the bundles, one to the other, the fact that it's exact means that the image of one map is the kernel of the next. Right? So the image of this map is the kernel of this one, the image of this one is the kernel of this one, and so forth. So in particular, if I take an element in here, and I map it into here, and then I map the same element across, I get zero. So what does this physically mean? Well, I have some bundle V, and here it has three-dimensional fibers. Three-dimensional fibers. And what you're saying is those fibers, that three-dimensional fiber, is living inside the four-dimensional fiber of this vector, of this bundle. So this bundle is a rank 4 bundle. It has four-dimensional fibers over each point that are fairly simple and you can describe. And you're putting a rank 3 guy with the fibers inside that four-dimensional vector space. So how is the position of that rank 3 fiber inside the rank 4 fiber determined? Well, it's determined by the kernel of this map. So what this part of the sequence means is V is inside this sum, basically. Where it is, well, the image of V, the image of this map, where V is inside here, is the kernel of this map. So the fibers, the pieces of the fibers that here that correspond to the fibers of V are all the bits of the fiber that map to zero when you do this map. It's just the kernel of this map. So you build up these more complicated bundles essentially by throwing them into various types of sequence. This is one known as a monad, there's others known as extensions, and then there's other methods of constructing bundles altogether. But I think I'm probably running out of time.
One more question?
Yeah.
So in this monad, obviously you have line to line of the map.
Yes.
So 1 to 04, which are a bunch of cubics.
Yeah.
Is it known whether there are bundle deformations that aren't polynomial like that in this kind of construction? You know, for complex structure, for instance.
Yeah, well, complex structure that you can overcount with the polynomials, right?
So these map moduli are not all the bundle moduli. You can actually compute a.
Yeah. So there are more bundle moduli.
You can
No, there's actually less. So what happens is not all of those are sort of unique combinations of the same module. So basically what you have to do is subtract off other modules.
Oh, sure. No, like, yeah. Yeah.
But other than that, you can't prove that this is up to these various identifications. This is all.
And is that a general result that they're all polynomial in this kind of construction?
So these type of, so there's more general moments than this one, where this, V is the four molecule for the bigger complex. And there it's not quite as obvious, but it is.
So it's exactly the same as in the complex structure, right, where the polynomials and whatever. So I should have said that for everybody else. So where this bundle was inside the sum is determined by this map. And you can make different choices of this map. And this corresponds to what people have been calling bundle moduli in the talks. I think explaining why this is polynomials is probably going to take me more time than I have.
So this one's polystable by itself?
Oh, sorry. This one's actually stable by itself. Yeah, so proving that is... The reason I haven't done it on the board is it's...
But in cases like this one, so it's always non-generic that it's polystable.
Very good. In general, what you get... So in this case, it was only polystable on a line. And you can get all sorts of cases. So you can get examples, like, for example, the standard embedding, where the bundle is stable everywhere. You can get other examples where it's stable in part of the Kähler cone. And for example, Lara talked about this. I think this one, Lara will know, is probably stable everywhere. Yeah.
Just one comment on that, since we're talking about the moduli components. There's more moduli in the bundle, like structure.
Yeah.
And it can be non-generic.
Yeah.
So you have to really make sure wherever you are in the moduli space.
But the easy one to see is the Kähler moduli space. And the reason for that is if you've got your Kähler moduli space and you're moving around, the slope stability really depended on this slope quantity, which was C1 wedge J wedge J. But J and J are if you have a basis of 1-1 forms, JI, these are the Kähler moduli. So which numbers you are getting really depends on where you are in this.
But can you use these deep terms? Can you turn this around and use it?
That's a really good. So can you spot, can you use D-terms to spot a stable bundle?
The other way around, can you choose bundles like this so that the D-term you get will stabilize at least those Kähler moduli?
That's what it's doing. That is stabilizing one modulus. Okay, the problem is, yeah, absolutely. The problem is you're never going to stabilize the overall volume like this.
In this particular case, would there be bundle moduli that would make it indecomposable and then you'd have to rework?
You know, I haven't actually looked.
There could well be, right?
I mean, is this is this the split locus of a monad? It may well be. And Lara was giving explicit examples of just that. No.
But that could happen, and that would complicate such an analysis, because really the bundle could just go off in the other direction.
Absolutely. But I should say what that would correspond to here is, in some sense, not changing the bundle moduli of this, because in some sense, this doesn't have any bundle moduli. Right? So the line bundles themselves are fixed by your choice of complex structure. They have no moduli. What that would correspond to is you'd work out a theory here and you'd have some charged matter in it, and you'd be giving VEVs to charged matter to me. Yeah, okay. But in some sense, that's just being pedantic.
But these odds have to be included in the D-terms, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. 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 And Lara gave an entire talk on this, right? So, for example, the D-term may look like, and I'm making this up, right, so it's not for this case, it may look like some destabilizing object's slope divided by the volume of the club EL, so this is just some number, or some function of the Kähler moduli, plus a bunch of charges times mod C squared, and as Ralph says, is you just have to solve this and get D equals zero. So in particular, if I moved in the Kähler moduli on the line, this thing is zero. So I can set all these matter fields to zero and have a solution. That's what this corresponds to. But as I went off the line, say I went off here, and this thing had became negative as a function of the Kähler moduli, then if I had a positively charged one of these guys, I could give it a BEV, cancel the D-term, and again I would get a solution to the D-term, and that would correspond to basically mixing these line bundles up into something more complicated, which may look, roughly speaking, like this. It may look like, in fact, in general, it will look like an extension, which is where you put the V in the middle. So you'd have sum of line bundles goes to V, goes to another sum of line bundles goes to naught. But it's a similar type of thing.
So just for the Cauchy analysis and projective spaces, which is over 7,890, can you just enumerate all of these kinds of bundles that have the right C2 and it looks like it?
That's exactly what we're doing in Oxford.
Okay.
So what we're doing is and this is why I've used these as examples, because I know them better, right? So what we're doing, in fact, there's a slightly more general thing than this. What we've done is taken all of the positive monads, where all of the numbers inside these are positive numbers over the CCs, and we've scanned for things like three-generation models with the right gauge group, all that lot. There aren't any. Positive monads over the CCs, up to one assumption we're making, which we're going to relax now, basically doesn't contain anything. So then we relaxed, so these numbers can be zero and negative, and that's what we're looking at now. And we have one sort of standard light model thing that we've found, with just, in fact, zeros and ones, which was mentioned earlier in the week. And we're just trying to scan things in this bigger set. I think we know now it's finite. We've looked at this 3-3 manifold again, because it's shiny. And you can sort of run it over these bundles and, you know, depending on what conditions you impose, there's billions of them. And then you start to impose more conditions like stability, necessary conditions for stability and all this stuff. And before dividing to go to a quotient manifold, at the moment on that manifold, we've got 8 left. So that's not as many as we would like, but you know, there's lots of these manifolds, so we'll keep on. But basically, that's what we're doing. We're trying some sort of carpet bombing approach to. Pretty good, yeah. But it depends hugely on what you, if you imposed anomaly cancellation, then it changes. And yeah, well, we do. Both. Wilson lines. So you have to have an equivariant vector. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, they're quotients. So what you have to do. So the basic problem is when you do all this, you get a gut group. You don't have to break it down to the standard model. The way you do that is your manifold has to have a non-trivial pi 1. And then you put some Wilson lines, some non-trivial gauge field configurations with zero field strength on that to break down to the gut group. The trouble is all the manifolds like this have pi 1 equals 0. So you have to divide them by a freely acting group, which you have to find. You then have to check that your bundle respects that freely acting symmetry, which is something called equivariance. And then you descend the whole thing down to the quotient manifold, and then you get your standard model thing, and that's what we do.
What about the modifier? How are you?
We do everything at the moment, more or less, at a random point in moduli space. The one exception to that is, for example, in this standard model we wrote down, it has a problem. I mean, any given model is likely to have a problem. The problem for that one, one of the problems for that one, is that it has no Higgs generically. So if I choose this map completely at random, you'll find it has no Higgs when you work out the standard model spectrum. So we've just sort of, one of the non-generic things we've done is we've just sort of tweaked the map to see if we can find a Higgs, and you can. But how much that means, I don't know. Okay, thanks.